successful meditation. You can't go wrong with that meditation. Whatever you find it is where you're supposed to be. You can't wander off. And after a while you're really peaceful. Do any of you feel sleepy? I did. But I took sleepiness, that big lunch. And I took sleepiness as my object. What's wrong with being sleepy? It's natural, it's just the brain learning just how and send a bit more energy down to my guts to digest the shepherd's pie which I had with the fish and chips today. Only a little bit of each, not that much.
And pudding.
Yeah, I can have only pudding.
Okay.
Only a tiny bit. And you know, I don't feel guilty. Because a long time ago, I gave up this blame and guilt and punishment business. But sometimes I wonder why we have like blame in this world. Because we blame others and we also blame ourselves. Why do we do that? And it may be that tradition which I was brought up in, and maybe many of you, that Judeo-Christian religion, it all started with original sin. Now look at that story, just how unfair that is. According to that story, the snake taught Eve into giving Adam an apple. And who got the blame for that? The snake? Nah. The guy? Nah. The women did.
Oh, God.
Is that fair? Is it Adam's fault? But anyway, it's the snake's fault. But anyway, I remember just talking to a Vietnamese about that story, and they said, if that Garden of Eden was in Vietnam, there would have never been original sin. Because Adam and Eve both would have eaten the snake. End of problem. But the whole idea of blaming someone, just seeing an apple is delicious and taking it, what's wrong with that? So anyway, why do we have this blame game? It's always somebody else's fault, not my fault. And if you look at yourself, it's not even your fault, but the blame gives rise to the terrible thing we call guilt. And also fear. The fear of failure and being blamed. And again, that starts from our education system. When you're told off, if you make a mistake, in maths or in class or anywhere. Okay, just to keep you awake, I'm going to give you a maths test. I used to be a maths teacher. Listen very carefully. 26 sheep in a field. 10 die. How many survive? You're very smart. Never answer a question by asking. It's always a trick to me. A smart Alex, put that up. 16! 26 minus 10 equals 16. And of course you say, wrong. And sometimes little kids, if I say wrong, can see their face, they made a mistake, they think they're right, and they feel they need to be blamed. But anyway, the answer, of course, is 10. As you all know. 26 sheep in the field, 10 die, 10 survive. It's obvious. 20 sick sheep. Sick, yeah. The same part, 26 sheep. People always say 26. But anyway, so sometimes people get into this blaming. And if you do get blamed, if you do not succeed, if you're not the very best, you feel you're inadequate. That failure is a personal stigma on you. To the point that you feel embarrassed and you hide your mistakes. Because you don't want to be blamed. And that becomes the source of things like lying. I always wondered, why is people lie? Because you lose more by telling the truth than if you lie. Think of it. There was this defendant who was on a murder trial where they still had the death penalty if he was found guilty. And during the murder trial, the defendant, some of his testimony, sometimes he said one thing, sometimes he said another. And even the judge interrupted and said, "Sir, do you realize the penalty for perjury is extreme?" He said, "Yes, but it's much less than if I'm found guilty and have to be executed." So in other words, if telling the truth has a more serious penalty, that's why we lie. Because we don't like, again, to be blamed, to make mistakes. Mistakes are not allowed in this world. And this, one of the stories where this originated from, because, you know, you're a Buddhist monk, Buddhist nun, that sometimes people really trust us. They trust us enough, and sometimes some of the people who go to our temple in Perth, they've grown up with me. 36 years I've been a monk in Perth, and 9 years before in Thailand. And over all those years, you know, people trust. So, one day, maybe 10, 15 years ago, this young girl came up to me, maybe about 18, maybe 17. Said, "Ajahn Brahm, I'm in big trouble. Can you help?" I said, "Of course, it's my job." Especially, you know, since we're really small. And he said, "I'm pregnant." So, "Have you told your mum and dad?" I said, "No, that's your job." "Then why don't you tell them?" "They'll kill me if they found out. They'll blame me, punish me." I said, "Number one, thank you. Thank you for trusting me, getting out of a difficult situation." And of course, I told my mum and dad, you know, just sometimes it happens in life, human beings. And just trying to punish them and trying to scold them, that just drives the truth out underground. And I was really surprised why it has to be that when a girl needs her parents more than ever, when maybe a son got involved in drugs, let's say, and they really need to tell their parents, they're afraid to tell. They're terrified what mum and dad will do to them, and the blame and the punishment which might come. And after I saw that, you realise why people hide the truth. So, to this day, whenever I have the privilege to do like a marriage lesson to somebody, I would ask them to please make that vow together, husband and wife, that you can say anything to one another, as long as it's the truth. And never be afraid to tell the truth. Don't fear blame, because we all make mistakes. Have you ever made a mistake? I've made many mistakes. I celebrate my mistakes. I learn from them. And the mistake I'm going to tell today is the time when I was called into the local hospital to the ICU unit because there was this elderly Chinese man who was in a coma, really sick, about to die. And the family wanted me to come in, so I rushed in there. And I did some Buddhist chanting, really focused and really give it a really superpower. Sometimes my chanting, "Whoa," really strong, really hits him. And it worked. I thought it worked anyway. He came out of the coma and came out of his disease. He's going to recover. And that was when the family got so upset. They come from their different countries. They took time off work to be with their father, their grandfather, their uncle, their whatever-in-law, to be with them the last moments. They'd even arranged a funeral service. And now this Western Buddhist monk comes in and spoils all their plans, so they have to cancel the funeral arrangements, go back to their countries, and they have to come back another 6 months later when he dies properly. But this time, I spoiled all their plans. They weren't not very happy with me at all. And so they blamed me. I said, you can't blame me. You should have let me know what type of chanting you want. To get better chanting or die peacefully chanting. So I learned a lot from that experience. Whenever I go and do any chanting or blessing for somebody, I ask them, what type of blessing do you want, first of all? To get better chant or the die peaceful chant. So when you make mistakes, you learn from them. And for goodness sake, don't feel you're blaming somebody or blaming yourself. Share it around. It makes life so much fun when you get it wrong. So I'm not embarrassed when I make mistakes, when I get it wrong, because that's being human. And it brings everybody down to this level of being a human being. So you don't be afraid of making mistakes. It's one of those rules which I established in monastery, which I run over in, I was supposed to run. That's a myth anyway. But I don't know, I'm away now. So who knows what those monks are getting up to. They're good monks, so I trust them. So because I trust them, because they're allowed to make mistakes, they don't make so many. They're not afraid of being blamed or punished. So that's one of the things which I say, you're allowed to make mistakes, because mistakes are part of learning. To the point where I was a school teacher for 1 year over in Devon in a town called Ottery St Mary. I chose that because it was a place of natural beauty. And at that school, I had to set my first examination in mathematics. That's why I learned things like 26 sheep and a pig. So anyway, so I never set a test before. So how do you set a test in math? I know my math, but I went to the senior teacher, he gave me some amazing advice, which I applied way beyond a test in mathematics, to life itself. Because he told me, if you set the examination too hard, and the average score is maybe 30% or 40%, then all of your students will come away thinking, they cannot do mathematics. They're hopeless at maths. Even though it's my mistake, because I was setting too hard. But that's what they would believe. But if you set it too easy, they got 95%, 99% scores, what would be the point of the exam at all? He said, aim for the average result, the average score of 70%, he told me. If the average score is 70%, 7 out of 10, the children in your class will come away thinking, yeah, they can do maths. 70% is a pretty good score. And with 30% where they made mistakes, that would give me, their teacher, feedback. That would be where I could discover their weaknesses. Places which I thought they'd understood, but the message hadn't gone across. The 30% was the growth, the learning, the place we can improve. And so I did that, and I realized that rule applies to life itself. If you score 100% in life, you may have an easy time, you don't learn much, you don't grow, life is just a bit too easy for you. If it's only 50%, 40%, then sometimes you get depressed and think life is too hard. But if it's 70%, you feel, yeah, you're making progress, but 30%, the most important part of life where you make mistakes, that is where you learn and where you grow. You don't blame anybody. You realize this is important. This is life itself. This is where we grow and learn. So, if you have a wife who is only 40%, then, yeah, it's a waste of time. If you have a husband who's 100%, dump him, not learning anything. If it's 70%, that's great, that's where you can both learn together. So this means that not blaming people for when things go wrong, you expect things to go wrong, and that's the beautiful part of life. When things go wrong, That's where we grow and we learn. That's real life. When things go well, that's just nice and easy. But it's where things go wrong, that's the most important part of life. And it's the most painful when things go wrong. It hurts. It's nasty. And of course, that was even nice just before I came here, just by the people giving me the fish and chips and the and all the other stuff, which is now happy in my tummy. So you don't blame me. You don't ask me, well, you know, just what happens when things do go wrong in life? And I think many of you know the story, but it's a great story. Sometimes when you leave here, when you walk back to the tube station or the bus or the car and you go back home, it does happen sometimes that you tread in a big pile of dog poo. So there's another story about that. There was this fellow who just, you know, not really paying attention, just texting, and he was walking down the road, he trod in some dog poo, and he just, you know, stood away and looked at his shoes, yuck. The next minute, this big Hell's Angel, he also walked into that poo. And a fellow who walked in there first said, I just did that. And the bike, he punched him. I suddenly get these jokes. The man said, I just did that. Yes. But the real dog poo story is you tread the dog poo, there's no bikies around, so you look at that. You never scrape it off your shoes until you go home. And then you scrape it off where? Under the apple tree. Because Randy's house had an apple tree in the back. Scrape it on the apple tree. Because if you scrape it off under the apple tree, 1 year later, your apples will be juicier and sweeter and more plentiful than ever before. And 1 year later, you'll pick those apples and you'll bite into them. Oh, this is nectar. So sweet and so juicy and succulent. And as the juice drips down your cheeks, you must always remember what you're really eating. It's dog poop you're eating. It is, that's where it's come from. What else could it be? It's dog poop, but transformed into the sweetest, juiciest apples. So you don't blame the misfortunes of life. In fact, if you have an apple tree, you go out looking for the dog poop, drop it as many pieces as you possibly can and take it home with you. Now, of course, the metaphor there is, you all know, that 30% where you make mistakes. That's what you don't try and ignore. You don't try and blame it somebody else's fault. You actually embrace the difficulties and faults in life. You dig it in to your garden, in your heart, and grow the most sweetest fruits of wisdom and compassion. That's where it comes from. The difficulties of life. So it means we don't blame life. It's the government's fault, it's somebody's fault, it's God's fault, it's somebody's fault. And don't blame your wife. You chose to marry her. Don't choose your husband. Blame your husband. You know, it wasn't a shotgun wedding. It is freely chose. That's one of the stories which I remember this lady over in Singapore telling me. Apparently it was a true story. When she was married to her husband, and of course she had to marry her husband, she couldn't marry somebody else, but anyway, you know what I'm talking about. But anyway, she got married, and after the marriage, her father took his son-in-law aside to give his daughter's new husband some words of advice. He said, son-in-law, you probably think my daughter is the most beautiful person in the world. She's wonderful, she's so pretty. I must be the luckiest person in the whole of Singapore. You probably think she's so charming and cute. Oh, everything she does is delightful and charming. Even the way she picks her nose is delightful. Well, that's what it's like when you're in love. Everything about the person you love is beautiful and charming. But, said the father, I know my daughter. In a few years' time, maybe two, maybe three, you will start to see the faults and defects in my daughter. But I want you to keep this in mind. Please remember this, son-in-law. If my daughter did not have those defects to begin with, she'd have married someone much better than you. It's true, isn't it? I said, don't blame. Oh, I never did marriage counselling. And I never. This one. Another wife, first of all. Oh, he's like this, he does this, he's terrible, he's really hopeless. And I asked the husband about the wife, oh, she's really awful and terrible and hopeless. You mean you both got lots of faults? But yeah. Well, there you go, you're a match. It's true, isn't it? So anyway, so we don't blame anybody. We actually make use of what we have to learn and to grow. Because if you start blaming somebody, it's somebody else's fault, it means we cannot do anything about it. If it's the government's fault, yeah, sure. You know, you elect a new one, what happens? Same. Maybe a little bit different. Different mistakes, but still not perfect. You get remarried. What happens? Guys, I do lots of marriage counselling. Girls, you try to think your husband is a faulty model, so you trade him in for a new model. Get remarried and you find just the same. Girls, just the same. Different chassis, the same engine. And don't blame me for this. Because then old Chandler invited me to give a talk, so instead of blaming people, it's somebody else's fault. Because if you start blaming other people, the next thing you do is start blaming yourself. Why did I do this? I'm hopeless. Now that is the worst thing, that self-blame. Because so many people get blamed by their parents for not being good enough, by their teachers for not being smart enough. It would be terrible at being at school. Go to an ordinary primary school, you do well, you get praise. What happens? Can you live on your praise? No, you get sent to a bigger school where it's so harder to actually to succeed in a bigger school. So you go to a bigger school, then you go to a bigger university. You're always trying to live up to being better. You can't do that. And I remember just used to go and play soccer. And actually I used to watch a soccer team. The soccer team, my father took me there first of all. I think it had taken me to a better soccer team. You know, it was actually the Fulham. And they kept on losing and getting relegated. It was one of the reasons I became a monk. I couldn't stand the suffering anymore. But then sometimes I remember watching those football games and blaming them. You know, you get the football player right in front of goal, he kicks it over the bar or misses it. I say, even my old grandmother could do better than that. And she was dead. It was so easy to blame when you're watching on the sidelines. But then later on in the afternoon, I was playing soccer, you know, just with some friends. It looks easy from the sidelines, but doing it yourself is much harder. So I realised, what am I blaming people for? I can't do any better. And quite frankly, even politicians. Could you do better? Sometimes we think even our old grandma could do better than that. But it's very difficult. So because of that, try not to blame people. Instead of blaming people, looking at their faults, because it's a lot of negativity and depression. So instead of blame, I prefer praise. Praising what's in the other person, which you really respect. Praising the good part of them. There's always some good in a person. So, that is where, if you feel you're inadequate, and I don't know how many of you recently read or knew about that book which Michelle Obama wrote. Highly successful woman, great role model, one of the, in my opinion, one of the best first ladies the United States has had, and she felt she was an imposter. But she didn't deserve all of those accolades. She didn't feel that she really lived up to her reputation. And she was an imposter. And a person like that, who I think of the whole world, they would focus, no, you're not an imposter, it's a wonderful job, well done. But for her, she never really appreciated her contribution. She felt she was an imposter. Where did that come from? It's original sin. We're not good enough. You're not good enough. There's something wrong with you. You've been blamed. You take on board what really doesn't belong to you, the faults which you weren't responsible for. I don't know how many times I saw this in places like London. I'm, you know, walking along the road, and then somebody bumps into me, and I say, sorry. Was it my fault? Your fault. I'm not going to say sorry. You were watching your iPhone, really, your iPhone. Or... That's one of the other little stories. So many people just, you know, communicate, they're watching their iPhone all the time. Just like, you know, when I was saying that, it was last night, that people who like bricklayers, they call them brickies. People who join motorbike gangs, they call them bikies. So what do you call people on the phone all the time? Phonies. I don't know if people like that. But it's true. So, anyway, so that we can just learn. Just, well, what was I with this before? Phonies. Anyway, you know, sometimes I, especially after a big rush, start to forget things. You know why? Because I live in the present moment. We teach other people, let go of the past. Don't worry about the future. Just be in the present moment. So what do you expect? No. So blaming. People take on the guilt of the world and think it's all their fault. And they blame themselves because we got used to that. Instead of blaming oneself, think of all the good things one has done. So to be able to do this, a very little simple exercise. You take a piece of paper. I did this with actually a prisoner about to be released. And he said, oh, I don't know how to survive out there, I'm terrible. Who would want to employ me after what I've done? So what have you done? And stop, don't tell me. I get a piece of paper out. Put his name on the top. A vertical line down the middle of the paper. All the terrible things you've done. Left-hand side. Give him a piece of paper and a pen. He wrote. Fill the left-hand side up pretty quickly. Now on the right-hand side, all the good things you've done. And nothing. I've done nothing. Nothing good at all. I'm hopeless. I'm terrible. I'm a bane on the world. But no, you must have done something. I've done nothing. Good. You know, what have you done today? Nothing. I hear you look after the prison cat. Oh, yeah. Well, did you give it a glass of milk this morning? A saucer of milk? Yeah, I actually gave it a saucer of milk. Put that down. Gave cat a saucer of milk. What else have you done? Oh, you know, well, actually, just, I just, it was cold outside, so I let it into myself so it can just have a bit of warmth. Put that in the book, in the list. Once they started seeing the good parts of themselves, you fill that right-hand side of the piece of paper very quickly. And then he was surprised. Hey, have a look. This is all the good you've done. You haven't done any good at all. Here it is. And he was actually surprised. He needed encouragement at first, but soon he realized there was many beautiful parts to his character. So get a pair of scissors, cut it down the center. The left hand side, all your faults, that goes in the rubbish bin. The right hand side, photocopy it, laminate it, keep as many copies as you can wherever you go, to remind yourself of your goodness. That'll just give you a big head. It doesn't give you a big head. It gives you a big heart. And if you're a monk or a nun, a big tummy. You know this is not actually fat. I had it checked. It's a big heart. Because every time, every year, when you're a monk, you practice compassion and kindness, open the door of your heart to others. And of course, every year, as a Buddhist monk, your heart grows and grows and grows. Soon it got so big it was pushing against my rib cage, and I didn't have anywhere else to go except down and out. I have to go somewhere. This is a big heart. Is it healthy? Well, you know, one of the religious mentors, one of those icons when I saw as a kid, I always wanted to live up to. You know, we have our role models in life and say, when I grow up, that's the sort of person I'd like to be. And that person, he was wise and generous and kind. and he would not discriminate, just, you know, who he would be kind and generous to. And he was old and fat even when I was younger. I still see him around today. Still alive, still around, still fat, and still generous and loving. You know who that is? Yeah. Santa Claus, yeah. So he was the image which I was looking up to. Santa. Immortal, fat. But on that, have you ever noticed, this is a totally off subject, but anyway, I never keep on subject with you well now. No, no, but really, well, I must be really out of character. But have you ever noticed that chubby people are always happy? You never see a miserable fat person. They're always laughing. Remember, actually I met them once, Harry Seacon, remember? Fat, very jolly, very happy. Who's the other fat, jolly people? But anyway, but wondered why you never see a fat, miserable person. And then I read a scientific article about your arteries, arteries and veins, your blood vessels. Every time you're happy or laugh, your arteries actually get wider, they expand. Every time you're negative, miserable, fault-finding, blaming, your arteries, your veins, they actually narrow. So if you are fat and negative, it's double whammy. You've got more gut going through your veins and arteries, and the veins are very small. Of course it could get clogged. It's like having heavy traffic, you know, down one of the small veins. But if you're fat and happy, it's like having some double width M25. No matter how much traffic goes through there, it never gets clogged or congested. It's so wide. Anything can go through. That is why happy people survive. Miserable people, especially miserable fat people, they die. So if you're a bit fat, overweight, good, laughing, that's going to save your life. Well, I did actually. When I went through the customs at, I think, one US airport recently, they looked at me and said, what have you got under your thing over here? He said, is it a suicide belt? I said, no, it's only fat. And he said, same thing. So anyway, so being blind. So what happens if someone blinds you? What would you do? It's like water, no, not just water off a duck's back. We have a simile in Buddhism about the lotus flower. You see, many, many temples, you have lotuses everywhere, and figures of lotus, and lotus ponds, and one of the similes of a lotus. If you are a lotus, and say a dog urinates all over you, a lotus never actually holds anything. Everything just drips off. And even urine. It all falls off the lotus, and afterwards, the lotus still smells like a lotus, and not as a urine. We've got this like repellent of liquid. And if someone comes by and pours Chanel number 5 over that lotus, that too doesn't stick to the petals of a lotus. It all falls off. And so afterwards, that lotus still smells like a lotus, not like a perfume. I remember that. Because people praise me. It's like pouring Chanel number 5 over me. It all rolls off. They blame you, like urinating over me. It all falls off. You keep nothing. But you know, many people, yeah, they can let go of the praise, but the blame is what they keep. That's really weird. Every time I say, General Chandra, what a great job you're doing, just starting off this bhikkhuni project, and fully ordained Buddhist nuns, equal standing, sorry, not equal standing, equal sitting, and just bringing this ancient tradition to its modern world, as it was, there were bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha. But why are they now? We can, we have, and now they're obviously, hopefully, to grow. So he wants to, so instead of, and I was not responsible for that. So, do I get blamed for it? Do I get praised for it? Very easy to keep blame. So, oh, why did I do that? Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Oh, why did I do that? When somebody praises you, oh, well done. General Chandra, being the pioneer, making it happen for other women here, and they praise, oh, that's nothing. Why is it we always accept blame far easily? More easily than we accept praise. And I saw this in my life once, many times. The first time was when I was given an award over in Australia. It was a medal for community service at a prestigious university in Australia. And as soon as, you know, when you get an award, like a medal, that, you know, you have to give your acceptance speech. And my acceptance speech was something like this. I don't know why you chose me. It was a surprise. Because there's so many other people who have done much more important work than I have done. And I couldn't have done this without the help of so many of my friends and supporters. But thank you anyway. What I was doing was rejecting the praise. Saying I didn't deserve it. There's more people more deserving. And I couldn't have done it without my friends. The next year, he was a professor of haematology at one of the big teaching hospitals in Australia. And as well as just, what he noticed is mostly dealing with cancer. And noticing that people who had cancer had the best medical treatment, but after they had the radiation therapy, chemotherapy, or the surgery, they were leaving the hospital without much aftercare. So he used his position as a senior doctor to kick out a few people from some rooms, get a sponsor and have an alternative therapy center, where every patient who'd been any treatment for any cancer could go in there and get a foot massage for free, get Reiki, acupuncture, what he said, anything weird, you can get there. For free. Not weird, but many people in the science profession thought it was weird. And He put his reputation on the line as a hard scientist for doing weird stuff, which was considered weird at the time. But he also was smart enough to actually to do the statistics to check out those people who went to the alternative therapy center compared to those who didn't. What were the health outcomes? And it was magic. People who went to the alternative therapy center, at least there were people there spending time with you. And they give you a foot massage, reflexology, and they were talking with you at the time. They're being kind to you. Not just in, out, as if you were on some production line. And that helped enormously. And for that, and he had the figures, the proof to prove how effective that was. That is why he was given the prize after me. And when he went up to give his acceptance speech, he said, "I don't know why you've given this award to me. There's so many other people in the medical and other professions who've done much better work than I have done. And I couldn't have done this anyway without the help of all my friends. But thank you anyway." I said, "Hang on, that's my speech from last year." Now why is it that someone is praised, they don't accept it? They're blamed. "Oh yeah, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that." They accept it straight away. Why is that? Because we've been trained to accept blame and to consider it and show remorse. But praise, well, no, that's ordinary. And afterwards, that professor, he did an amazing job, well done. Hey, maybe that I deserve my prize as well. Afterwards, I thought, hey, maybe I did. Why do I always reject praise? But I only accept blame. Because I always was taught, if you accept praise, you get a big head. You don't, you get a big heart. So this bhikkhuni sitting next to me, courageous, brave, by herself, starting something amazing and new in London, in Oxford, in England. Do you accept that? Excellent. Very good. Okay, round of applause. Okay. So it's weird, isn't it? We always accept, mostly accept the blame, not the praise. So instead, if we just water the weeds in a garden, then the weeds grow. Water the flowers grow. One of the best pieces of praise I've ever got, and I'll take this to my grave, if I actually go to a grave, I'll take it to the crematorium, so that's where I end up, whatever happens to me. So, one of the greatest pieces of praise was when I was called up by, I used to do a lot of work in prisons, and called up by one of the prison officers. They said, "Can you please come back and teach in our prison, our jail? So I'm too busy these days, I've got to go to London, I've got to go to New York, I've got to do this, got to do that." I sent somebody else. "No," he said, "we want you." Why me? And then he gave me this wonderful praise, which I will never ever forget in my life. He said, "Because every prisoner who came to your classes, once released, never comes back to jail." I've never seen this before. But what you've been doing, but zero recidivism. I thought, wow, what have I done? I think one of the things which I did do, I think the main reason, you saw a prisoner, and some really nasty people in there for nasty crimes. But I never, all those years I went into jail, I never ever saw a rapist, I never saw a thief, I never saw a murderer, I never saw a false, I never saw a criminal in the jail. All I ever saw was the person who had raped. I saw the person who had murdered. You know that story of the two bad bricks and the wall? One of the people in the local jail, he read that story, he said, "There's only two murders, only two bad bricks and the wall." I don't know how you think about that, but that was the start of his rehabilitation. to get out and have a job. Instead of staying in jail all the time, you would never murder again. All those people went into my classes. I never saw them as criminals. People were far bigger than that stupid, terrible, hurtful thing they had done. When they saw the other part of themselves, the right-hand side of that piece of paper, the beautiful side of themselves, they had the opportunity to forgive. They were worth forgiving. They were worth rehabilitating. They felt that themselves. Two of the prisoners in particular, they were selling drugs, which is a terrible thing to do because there's so much harm in our world. Selling drugs, in jail, family all busted up, and afterwards, the local school teacher in a primary school had the nerve, the courage, the wisdom to invite those two drug dealers into her primary school to teach the children what really happens when you start getting involved in illegal drugs. The education system were giving money to actually to do some classes for even primary school children to make sure they never get involved in drugs. Getting policemen, psychologists, professors, and that just didn't work at all. You get someone who really knew firsthand what it was like when you get into trouble with drugs. These two prisoners spent the day in a primary school. It was not put in the newspapers at the time, thank goodness, otherwise the newspapers would have just roasted that principal. But when I saw what happened afterwards, the day afterwards, every class where those two prisoners taught from the heart the pain which happens when you're involved in drugs, the kids were asked by the teachers to show thanks by writing little cards to these two prisoners. One I'll never forget, his name Nick. "Dear Nick, thank you for coming to our school. We'll never take drugs." Sarah, age 9. "Oh, thank you, Nick. Please come and see us once you're released." Signed, Stephen. "Thank you, we learned so much about what drugs really do to you." Thanks, Mary. Age 10. You can see from those letters, they had made an impact, they had connected. They were the experts, those who were in pain and hurting so much for what they'd done. But when Nick was showing me all these letters, heaps of them, I never seen a man weep so much, crying his eyes out. He'd atone in a little way for what he'd done by helping so many other kids not follow in his footsteps. And of course, once he was released, I saw him again at an airport waiting to receive somebody on the aircraft, and hand on my shoulder, turned around, and there was Nick. He said, "Look, in nice dress, nice suit.
Could be,
but he was actually wearing a suit. And he said, "I've got my own little business, successful." And he said, "I'm still meditating every day, bro. I'm still meditating every day. Thank you so much." But I think the biggest thing was him being given a chance to pay back some of the harm he'd done by helping others. Never judge a person. You blame them. There's so many other things to them. Don't just see the weeds. See the flowers. When you water the flowers, not the weeds, it's the flowers that grow. Somebody makes a mistake, they know they made a mistake. Care for them. To guide them through. The fact they made a mistake doesn't mean they're a hopeless person. It doesn't mean they're a waste of time. Guide them through the next steps. Not a blame. Find something to praise. And realize they're much more than the faults which they have done, which cause them so much trouble. That's why blame doesn't work. We don't ignore it. Acknowledge it. Learn from it. But also focus on the beautiful side of human beings. It's there in everybody. That's why I kept inviting back to Joe. See somebody, don't see the faults, see the beautiful side. And that's what grows. Okay. So, I better not go on any longer. Otherwise, I won't get blamed. Will I? No, okay.